This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, of course. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, of course. 204. What a great show. Da 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 da. Don't you know? Alex Borstein, Rachel Brosnahan, Amy Sherman Palladino.
Make. Is that article you sent me that I didn't read?
Oh, and you said, we'll read. Thanks.
Well, what I meant was when I said you will read, I meant you're going to summarize it.
And you're absolutely right. And I have full quotes and I have citations and stuff.
Make Susie gay.
Make Susie gay, you cowards. It's an article
make
we can discuss.
Susie gay, you guys, you
make
cowards.
Make Susie gay. Welcome to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goys. I'm Kevin.
And I'm Alice.
And we're the Maisel Goys. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. 204. This is, I love recording like this. We're four episodes into the season. Mm. We have not released any of them.
Ooh, it's so good.
But
I just got to ask, somebody asked me on Instagram when we're making more episodes, and I was like, oh girl,
oh my God. Isn't that fun?
It's like, so fun.
Well, I got to the point where I didn't put out a Twitter Q&A because every other question last time was, when's it coming out?
Yeah.
And the whole appeal is like, it's casual, it's fun, it's just like a little, you know, toss
yeah,
off 10
episodes. We know
episodes
you're all
gonna
binge
there.
Immediately the entire series when it comes out, so what's
I don't know
the
if
point?
That's true anymore. And actually, that's why I'm fine putting it out a month
right.
later.
Well, that's the thing, too, is like, yeah. even if they are going to binge it immediately, it's like, why would we try to stay on top of that?
Yeah.
That's girl. Crazy.
Yeah, and it was
we
hard.
Have to binge it really quickly.
And we don't
like,
have advanced
stupid.
Screeners, Amazon,
ain't no
one,
no,
Jeff,
don't.
Mr. Bezos.
Mr. Bezos, another call from a podcast. Marvelous.
Wait, is that the one with Alice and Kevin? Put them on immediately.
Put them on in the den. My office has a den.
Oh, 204.
Maybe you should pitch it to him. Marvelous Mr. Bezos.
Shut up!
Marvelous Mr. Bezos, guys.
Oh, my God. Well, let's introduce our guest.
Let's introduce our guest.
He put out some gold.
You know, yeah, he put out some gold. Let's bring out this little gold digger
putting
onto the stage.
Putting out some gold sounds like peeing.
Okay. I'm changing the guest intro music to this for this episode because
oh,
it was
awesome.
Featured and it feels more fun.
Yeah, it does.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know him from his own podcast, West Wing Weekly, or Song Exploder, or a wonderful multifaceted presence on social media. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Hrishikesh Hirway!
Hrishikesh Hirway. Welcome to Marvelous Maisel Goys.
Welcome to Marvelous Maisel Goys.
Rishi, thanks for joining us on the show. Rishi, you're going to find this is our shortest episode we ever do together.
Oh, yeah?
Rishi and I have not recorded. Rishi, of course, was a mainstay of Gilmore Guys. Starting in season 5, that episode went 2.5 hours and began with an hour-long tech difficulty delay.
Oh, my God.
And then last time we recorded was Colin, A Year in the Life. And that was a good 4 hours and 20 minutes long.
It was pretty long.
Around
okay,
that.
So that's why he... Okay, that's why you have the sleeping bag and the blow-up
yeah.
mattress.
That's why he's in his jammies.
That's why he's in his jammies.
But this is going to be easy breezy peasy. It's going to be great.
I sent an away message on my email.
I'm recording an episode of a Kevin Porter podcast. Yeah. Hold my calls till February, I guess. I was so excited to come here today because I both count you as actual friends of mine, not just like podcast Duh. Colleagues, but
Aww.
It's just like a fun hangout. So maybe we'll have trouble reining it in for a short 90-minute
session.
Ooh,
I love when there's trouble reining it in.
Ooh, trouble reining
now,
it in.
Now, Rishi and I just met, mm-hmm. and I feel weird about that because the way that I busted in, and I'm a whirlwind of a person.
You almost said a buster.
I'm a buster. I'm the buster to your Dave. How about that?
I'll take it. I will.
But I feel like I presented myself because of our discussion as a bit of a sociopath. So I'm going to be working hard to earn back your trust as a human.
No, you did it just with that Dave and Buster analogy.
That's all it takes.
It's where adults come to have fun.
That's right.
It's the ultimate adult playland.
And we co-own it.
Adults only.
We've curated it.
Oh, boy. Well, Rishi, we didn't have you on for season one of Maisel Goys.
Yeah.
But you were a fan.
I was.
Yeah.
Fan, yeah.
Well, what were your thoughts on, like, the show in general when it came out? Your expectations for it, especially after Year in the Life stuff. How'd you get into it, and what was your general impression?
It's my favorite Amy Sherman-Palladino joint.
Ever.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think the technical pedigree is undeniably the best, obviously.
I think, you know, it has so much of what I like about the spirit of Gilmore Girls without the annoying town stuff.
Oh, the annoying town stuff.
Yeah.
Townie
stuff. I like that take.
That was always my 50% issue with Gilmore Girls. Like, I loved, if the show could have just been Emily and Lorelai the whole time, it would have been the greatest show of all time. And then I would just have to wade through all the town people stuff.
I tell you what, man.
Like, it would always knock a couple of Mrs. Whatever's dance recitals off of here.
Yeah, yeah.
Her name is Miss Patty.
Miss Patty's
Mrs.
dance recitals.
Patty, thank you.
Off your review at the end.
Well, this was.
I understand that.
This was a pre-homecoming world where you could do a drama in 30 minutes or less sometimes. So there wasn't a precedent for it. But I think no show, maybe including this one, would not benefit from. I just watched Homecoming season one in like a day. And there's no part of it where I was like, I wish it lasted 20 more minutes per episode. It's just like, great.
Yeah.
This is great.
It's sweet.
We don't need to do category fraud with like.
And there's so, it's such a richly, like, there's so much space in the show.
Yeah.
It's not like a show where it's like, pop, 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 it doesn't keep moving really quickly. They tell the story with enough background information for you to get what's going on. And there's space to like, look at this weird pelican for a minute, you know?
That's right.
It's great.
And they still made it feel like a page turner or whatever the TV.
I was telling, I watched it and I was like, it's like watching a novel.
Yeah, beautifully done.
I'm very smart.
Okay.
Does anybody?
Is this an episode of The Marvelous Mrs. Homecoming?
Oh, I got my pineapples and I'm eating all the drugs.
Julia Roberts.
But in
what's her name? What's her
Thank
name?
You.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, for a person that may have a little bit of distaste for the townie stuff, boy, we picked an episode that.
Yeah.
I mean, how reminiscent can you get of town meetings and everyone gathering?
Oh, it was so town
singing
meeting-y.
Of the songs when they're doing the orientation for Steiner Camp or whatever.
One of the
it's
things
called.
I love about Amy Sherman-Palladino's world is that we have these rich characters that they're at the forefront of our experience of the world. Like, we are experiencing the world through Midge Maisel's eyes or through Lorelai or Rory's eyes. Then we have to go sit with these morons that are cartoon characters.
Yeah.
And they're literally two-dimensional, you know, in some ways. And they're just so, and then you watch them and they're like, this is my favorite thing in the world. And you're like, no, it definitely can't be. You know what I mean? Like,
or if it is, that doesn't convince me that it's enjoyable because you're dumb.
Yeah.
And if you like it,
it takes down my esteem of you.
Yeah.
A couple notches.
Rishi, as someone who has hosted a television recap podcast for 2.5 years now, how long has it been since you started West Wing Weekly?
Something like that. It was started March 2016.
Four more years.
So when you watch TV shows now, and especially ones like this where like sometimes you guest on shows like this and talk about it, is it hard to turn off kind of the ones and zeros in the Matrix perspective of like, oh, I see what they're doing in Act 1 and Act 2 and like...
No, not at all.
Okay,
no,
you can just like take it in.
It's more like I have to remember to turn it on.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Hmm. That's great. I will say my experience for this episode in particular was different because usually I watch these on a computer and just like in my bed, like not in a lavish setting. And that was the case for all the Gilmore stuff and all the Bunheads stuff. It's just like watching on a computer. But I just recently, for the first time in my adult life, bought a TV. I'm watching on that in my living room. And it feels great. It feels like I'm going to the movies.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I will say, it changes I didn't think it would be. I thought it'd just be like, oh, it's bigger or whatever. But it's like, it changes the way I emotionally process the thing because oftentimes, especially even with this show, I would watch the show literally in my Adobe Premiere workspace the desktop where
so
it's
you
like,
could clip immediately.
So I clip while I'm going because it's more efficient, so I don't have to watch it twice and blah, blah, blah. But now I want to watch it twice. So I'm going to watch it once on the TV and then I'll watch it twice so I can just experience it.
Yeah.
Because I was losing that, especially at the end of those seasons.
Yeah, that's why you've been such a cynic.
What? A cynic? I only watched in all of Gilmore Guys stuff, the only episodes I watched on a TV was A Year in the Life.
Wow.
Those are the only ones. The rest were all on computer or like in the editor thing. So I'm looking forward to becoming an audience member again rather than just like a little editor stashed away in his office with his bottles full of pee and whatnot.
Wait,
no, it's long hours. No, don't judge me. It's fine.
You're at home though, so you
yeah, that's
go
right.
To the bathroom.
Yeah, the bathroom's right there.
Huh.
But it's far away. It's still a little far away. Let's talk about this episode in particular though. Episode 204, we're going to the Catskills and the Amazon Prime synopsis is the Weissmans arrive in the Catskills for their annual summer trip and attempt to settle into familiar patterns. Whispers of Midge and Joel's separation cause Rose to poke around her daughter's love life. Susie must adjust her summer plans in an effort to keep her and Midge's career momentum going. And now it's time for a segment we do on every episode of this podcast. Called
12 o'clock rock. We're gonna
pop
around
the culture
tonight.
Pop around the culture tonight, where we take every single pop culture reference in the episode,
got it,
and put them in a supercut. So this is 204. We're going to the Catskills.
Should I go classy,
your Doris Day,
or risque,
your Mamie Van Doren?
Did you see that Tony Curtis said that kissing Marilyn Monroe was like kissing Hitler?
Kissing Hitler? How would Tony Curtis know what kissing Hitler was like?
That's it.
Oh,
it's just there
was,
that.
There was
oh, was
one
there one more?
Oh, Rishi.
Right before the
Eagle Eye.
The kissing Hitler thing, there was a mention of, you know, in that same scene when they're in the beauty parlor, it's not super audible, but they said something about finding Glenn Miller's body. He was still holding his trombone.
They never found his body.
Hey, did you find Glenn Miller's body?
No.
Yeah. He was still holding his trombone.
Glenn Miller was killed when he was 40, you know, in an airplane, and they never found his body. They still don't know exactly what happened. And then, like, I think in 2017, there was a book that came out that said, okay, this is what actually happened, and it was pilot error.
It was a pilot error.
It was pilot error, yeah. They thought maybe he'd been killed in friendly fire, but then there's this journal that came out because of Antiques Roadshow. Somebody had this journal, and in it there was a diary entry, and they discovered that like the person had put in their diary that they had seen this plane, and somebody they'd figured out that the plane that he was talking about was the plane that Glenn Miller was on, and therefore it was like way off course.
Oh my God!
And yeah, so it had been this like mystery from World War II for a long time, and they just figured out in 2017.
That is loaded.
And so I imagine maybe, you know, the Paladinos had heard about this in 2017 and then like found a way write it in.
Work it in.
Yeah, in this very, very quick.
Totally.
Oh, that's so awesome.
So that's another, I mean, you've been watching on the TV and you missed it.
I did. So, I was too much of an audience member that was just swept away in the emotion to put
now
on
you're
my
torn.
My thinking. Yeah.
You can't.
I'm lying on the ground naked.
Nothing's right.
Yeah, nothing's right. The illusion never changed. Oh boy. But yeah, very light other than those like the three or four little references.
Yeah. Which, thank you.
I mean, I didn't miss them.
No.
This is one of the shortest in all the 200 whatever.
No.
What we've done.
How do you feel, Rishi, about the pop culture references?
I like them. I mean, I think of them, the stuff like that, like the Mamie Van Doren, whatever. But the world is so informed by the Lenny Bruce existence. You know, the fact that Mom's Mabley and real comedians exist.
Yeah.
I guess those would be considered pop culture references, but they really, I think, are sort of like the building blocks
the
of the show.
The texture of the actual cloth.
Yeah, so I appreciate them.
It's strange to have a show where, I think we talked about this before, where like in Gilmore, they would reference probably Lenny Bruce or something, and now the pop culture reference is a character on the show. It's an actual like story point and texture in the thing. And I guess there's one other big pop culture reference, but it's not verbal.
Wow.
It's visual. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh my God, what is it going to be?
It's the opening.
Oh, right.
The opening of the entire episode.
With the truck. With the kid and the, yeah.
With the kid and the toys, but they're not toys. Here, I'll play a little bit of it. It is the great Elmer Bernstein and the title track cue from To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's exactly how that movie opens, too. So that whole thing is just like a...
Right.
It's almost like a fan... I mean, it makes sense. It's Daniel Palladino on the ones and twos, but it's like a Family Guy joke where it's like, it's not a reference. It embodies the reference.
You know, I Shazammed that song and it didn't come up. Nothing came
really?
Up.
Really?
Yeah, Shazam let me down.
Well, this is one of the great things about the Amazon player. You pause that thing in web version, you can see who every actor is and what song is playing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which makes it really easy to put together like playlists and soundtracks for the show.
What's it called? Amazon X-ray?
Amazon, I think it is like Amazon X-ray or something like some about crazy branding like that. But I like that. It's helpful when you're watching stuff.
Yeah.
So you can quickly identify like an omnipresent, that guy, like Saul Rubinek in this episode.
My God, Saul Rubinek.
Mr. Saul Rubinek.
That's crazy. Because I just did a Trex episode with Saul, not with Saul Rubinek, but that he was a part of, and then got tweets about him appearing in a Maisel episode.
Yeah, he's just in this one. And and like the previous three episodes we've done before, I've only watched up to this. I have not seen 5 through 10 of this season.
This time I didn't even let it play forward to see the first few clips of the next one. So I'm totally
because you get confused and think it's the same episode.
But this one I don't think maybe I will. Who knows?
Oh, we'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah, but I love, people may, television fans may remember Saul Rubinek as the guy that Daphne almost marries in Frasier. That was my first introduction to him. And then he's like scenery chewing and True Romance. He's like in every other. He's great in Buster Scruggs, if you guys have seen that.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, he's in the last little short of that one. And he's really, really good. He's 70, too. He does not look 70. He looks a little bit younger than that to me.
He looks like he could lay some pipe.
Excuse me?
All right.
What's this now? So we're going to the Catskills. Written and directed by Daniel Palladino, which I was...
Surprised by me too. I know. I was like, good job, Daniel. I'm proud of our guy.
I was texting a friend of mine who actually may come on the show later in this season, but I was like, I didn't think it was a Daniel episode at all. And then she pointed out one scene where it's like, don't you think this scene was classic Daniel? And then in retrospect, I was like, oh, you're totally right. And it's this little set piece when they first get to Catskills.
Air out a little.
Come on, guys.
Oh, the house.
Oh my God.
All the cabin commotion. And I'm not going to play all the clip. It does last a minute and 30 seconds.
I did fast forward through it.
Yeah.
On my rewatch. Because I watched the show, and then in preparation for today, I rewatched last night, and that was like, I can skip this. I got it.
Oh, it's just nonsense.
Yeah.
It's just like a lot of
endless.
Noise.
Well, it just looks like a set piece. I mean, it's like from a play.
Mm-hmm.
It's a specific, it looks like an opera.
There was an AV club recapper named Ariel Bernstein who cited that a lot of this episode in particular felt Wes Anderson-y. I think in the color palette, it does seem like a lot like Moonrise Kingdom. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we should stop making the Wes Anderson references because Wes Anderson was so derivative of female filmmakers that were lost to history.
Like who?
Exactly.
I was going to see if you could name one.
Well, I don't know, but I'm not a film scholar.
Right. No, and I agree. But
like,
you're saying
stop the
references.
I think we should start attributing, like being like, when people say like, oh, that looks like a Wes Anderson movie, we should say like, well, let's figure out what Wes Anderson was stealing from, and then we'll reference what that was.
That's like you wouldn't say that reminds you of an Elvis song. It reminds you of a Big Mama Thornton song, right? Is that the woman he stole the music from?
I don't want to become that person, though, I guess.
Actually, it reminds you of Big Mama Thornton.
Wait, I do want to become that person.
Yes, you
I'm
do.
360. I like it. I like it. Oh. I like to be, and I'd like it to be in passing, like walking by people at a first date, you know?
Right. And you're not friends with them. Nope. You're not a part of the conversation.
No, 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 no. Ooh,
and it's like, actually,
good.
You're thinking of French filmmaker, ba 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 da da da.
Yeah. Ba 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 da da da. Underappreciated in her, their time.
Yeah. Ba 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 da da da, what she did for the medium in terms of framing mm-hmm. and composition mm-hmm.
and rhythm.
Right. And a rhythm. There's the scene where she tells Susie that she's initially going to the Catskills. And Susie's reaction kind of embodied my reaction as a viewer in terms of what this yep. does for yeah. the narrative momentum of this season as a whole.
But I'm going to the Catskills.
Yeah, yeah. Get your record skipping, Missy. Get to the point.
I'm going to the Catskills for 2 months.
Jeez, I almost did a spit take.
Almost. That was a fucking spit take.
You're going to the Catskills for 2 months?
I told you a million times I was going to the Catskills.
Yeah, but I figured it was 5 days tops, not 2 fucking months.
It's got the guy in back of me, too.
What the hell do you do up there for 2 months?
Lots of things.
What things? You look at a tree, you go to bed. You get up, you look at a tree. You're going to do that for 2 straight months? What the fuck is going on up there?
There's activities. We go boating, we sunbathe. What do you do for the summer?
I stay here, and I sweat, and I smell like a bum, and I'm miserable, and I want to kill people, and I do that till it gets cold.
I do love, too, the blocking and the move of them stealing a booth once the previous party is vacated.
Yes.
Like you see in coffee shops all the time.
Yes. It illustrates the regularity with which they go to that place, but I interrupted what you were about to say.
Oh, I was a little offended that I got saddled with an episode that has no stand-up in it.
That
I got,
no.
I did get the town, so I got the town version.
The townie!
Wow.
Of Maisel. I was like, wow, all the
karma,
stuff.
A little bit.
Yeah, maybe.
Karma for yeah. why? What did he do?
I don't know. I'm not looking at the karma police
look,
here. I'm just saying it probably has something to do with some horrible evil that he's done.
Oh, no. I don't believe it for a second. Yeah, but that was totally unintentional. Sorry. I didn't know that you hated townie stuff so much, BT does.
Really?
Yeah, but then also I wasn't very judicious in the assignment either.
Because also, I wasn't paying attention to anything you ever said during the work.
Yeah.
Well, because when I said, oh, it's 204, you sent me emojis. And I was like, I don't know what those mean. I haven't watched it yet.
That's right. I sent you a bikini emoji.
Right.
Well, that was correct and appropriate.
It was correct.
And an umbrella emoji.
Yeah, but isn't it fun to investigate the things that maybe aren't our first choice in a way?
Yeah.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
See, and this is why I like going episode to episode. For this show and not doing the, and maybe by 205 I'll have binged them all, but doing it currently, it reminds me of old school TV watching where this is such nostalgia BS, but like there was this teeny tiny moment in television watching culture, but then internet like discussion, discourse, and recap culture where there was still sort of monocultural, like, we're all going to talk about The Sopranos for 7 days until the next one. Mm-hmm. We're all going to talk about like Breaking Bad or, you know, whatever like the network equivalents were.
Yeah.
And we have to think about them and digest them for a week. We cannot skip. And it's not like the thing now where it's like, oh, I haven't started yet. I'm on season two. I'm on season five. Well, they put out the 10 episodes today. Oh, I can't do it. And I love the digestion because it does force you to digest the things that are like a little more mediocre.
Yeah.
I know I've said this on the show before, but it makes you dislike the things you dislike more, but it makes you like the things that you really like even more when you go at that pace. Rather than like if you watch all six seasons of Lost in like 2 weeks or something, that's such a different experience than watching it over 6 years because you'll be like, oh yeah, it was good, I liked it. Rather than like, I hated this thing in season three, but oh my gosh, that episode in season four, the constant bubble. Like it just, you just feel everything more. Do you find that to be the case with like doing West Wing Weekly stuff?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is your retention changes a lot.
Yeah.
When you only watch one per week. When you're binging 10 episodes in 2 days, like I did with this show when it came out, it takes me a second to remember what happened when, like what plot line, how things were threaded and what events, you know, separated them out, which scenes came after which. I just remember what happened, but not necessarily exactly how it was told. How
I
it
spilled
all
my soda. I'm sorry.
Well,
so I have to go deal with
it. Alice, you can get some paper towels. Actually, I have another question for you. We could keep talking about
it great.
Until you're gone. Because I did have this almost like existential question while watching this show, and then I was switching back between like Homecoming and Killing Eve. Have you watched that?
I have.
Yet? And there was a part of me that was like, I loved Homecoming so much. I thought it was like, it's heavy, but it's really fun. And it's breezy in a way that sometimes like his other stuff, Mr. Robot, isn't, where it's like, this is an important work and blah, 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 blah. And Killing Eve, I thought was just fun. It was just like, it was almost like Carly Rae Jepsen music or something, where like, this is such a pop sensibility.
Yeah.
It felt like the Poptimism equivalent of TV shows. But then there was a point where I was like, am I going to remember this 2 weeks from now? Am I going to remember like, oh, that scene where Jodie Comer gives Sandra Oh this look, and like, and it almost created this weirder, like, larger question of, and not to dog on any of the things that we do on all of our respective current podcasts that we all do, but it's like, what is the value of watching great TV? And if retention is like a fundamentally large part of it, because it feeds into like community aspects. And when I make this reference about like CJ wearing the hat on Air Force One and you understand it, whereas like if you had just binged it all in a weekend, you'd be like, yeah, I kind of remember that or something like that. Because it almost feels like it gets even into Eternal Sunshine, the Spotless Mind stuff, where it's like the memory is the thing after a certain point. Because if you don't remember it, it's like it never existed to a degree. So, like, do you feel that when you watch shows and then have a heart? Because there's been shows that I've loved watching and I just don't remember anything about it.
Yeah, but I think that if you, I don't know if it's for the social aspect of it, but mm-hmm. I think any art that you take in, the more time you spend with it, the more of a chance you're giving it to affect you.
Mm-hmm.
You could watch something one time through and be like, oh, I loved it. And maybe you don't remember it, but then if you watch it a second time and the third time, I mean, how many times have you watched some of the things that you love, the things that you do feel like have permeated your existence?
Yeah, like 15 times.
Yeah,
probably,
yeah. It doesn't necessarily come from just one splash
binge
watching. And I think that's just what it takes.
But then it gets into that prioritization of like, well, right. I want to watch this. But then that's time occupied by like my 16th go around of whatever, 30 Rock or Parks and Rec or something, and like a further permeation of that into my existence, where it's like, I did see Paddington 2 13 times last year. And
wait,
I would.
You were about to be like, I mean, not 8, 13. It's like,
well, 8 times in theaters and then a few more at home. But I would have much rather that than like Bumblebee, which got a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, it just creates this weird anxiety in me about, like, and this is like a very peak TV conversation we're having.
But it doesn't just have to be. I mean, because I was thinking about, I feel the same way about books. There are books that I love that I've read three times. And every time you do that, you know, if you think of your book reading time as a zero-sum game, then it's like, well, I could have read another book once instead of this book for the third time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then what time would you have spent researching to find out what that book is?
And what would I have not gotten? You know, what did I get from? I got things from having read that book for the third time. And what would I have not gotten?
Yeah,
by skipping out on that.
I know, it's all these like little micro decisions we have to make all the time.
Well, I think also like I'm thinking of it as the person, the creator. Like if
Tyler.
I'm making TV. I hate you.
I hate you too.
If I'm making television, which I am, watch Resident Alien on Sci-Fi next year, there's something about, you know, like you have to let go of a certain amount of like expecting people to make your show into a cult hit if it's not delivering the goods, you know? But like I don't feel like watching TV and then forgetting it is... Like, I feel like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, the message was more like, it isn't the memory. It's the experience of it and being present with it that is the point. Because they did it all over again. Mm-hmm. And if they had the memory intact, they wouldn't. So the memories were really useless. You know, with the memories, they would have had a less rich experience of what we come to care about as the viewer, which is them two being together. the memories don't would prevent that from happening. So it's more about like experiencing things with fresh eyes. And, you know, I remember, to me, every show that impacted me that I like, I remember. And if I had a good time watching it, I'm not going to say like, I'm not going to say I remember every single aspect of it, but I remember the feeling of it, the important parts of it that I took away. Then those are my thing to take away.
Right. And so like positive impact isn't measurable in solely memory or retention.
Alone. I also feel like I'm not binging anything like more than 2-3 episodes at a time.
I know this
Who
is
are
true.
These people?
Because Alice and I have been watching West Wing for 2.5 years and we're in season 3.
I don't want you or anyone else in my house.
I know.
For that long.
You've told me that so many times.
My boyfriend, I don't want in my house for that long. So I don't understand who these people are that can sit for, I mean, like, don't you get bed sores?
Party
like,
one. Rish is raising his hand right now.
Right here.
Looking so sheepish.
Oh, my
but
gosh.
I guess I love it.
I'm like,
what's wrong
so
with me?
Much.
Well, I can if I'm doing other things, maybe. Like, I've been rewatching The Good Wife. Just because I can't wait for The Good Wife to come
back. It's pronounced place, The Good Place.
No, The Good Wife.
Oh, it's pronounced fight, The Good Fight.
No, The Good Fight is the new, I mean, I cannot wait. I know you know what you're saying, but like.
It's pronounced girl, The Good Girl. It was a movie with Jennifer Aniston.
The Good
Aniston.
Girl.
The Good Girl. It was an indie movie from 2003.
Not to be, well, so I have been thinking a lot recently, this is a little bit of a morbid thought, but I think about the thing that people say when someone has died. This is like a sort of a cliche that people won't remember what you said or what you did, but they will remember how you made them feel.
Okay.
And I think that that's sort of what you're saying about TV that you love as well.
Yeah.
It might not be, you might not have a shot for shot memory of how something unfolded, but you remember how you felt about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what thing I say that makes people laugh. You know what I mean? Like my if you repeat one of my brilliant jokes
you're
to
just
one of,
talking
to
about
one
friends
of your friends.
Now. You're not talking about an audience.
Like they're not you're not gonna be able to get the same, you know, but it's like you'll be like, I like that. That person's funny.
I think this is true because my memory of Thanksgiving 2016, that felt like Christmas because I was texting all of you guys and we were all in it together. It was so fun to just like feel like, it felt like how people must feel when like certain movies come out, like the first Star Wars movie in 20 years or something. Like that felt like, more ways than one, maybe like the anticipation and like collective moment of the Phantom Menace and like texting friends of like, oh, I credited this part. What'd you think of this part? And like FaceTiming people.
Totally.
And, like, and I'll remember that memory much more than I remember like what happened in summer. So like a Wookiee did something.
Yeah. Oh
I don't
my
remember.
God. You have no idea.
Right?
And better for the creators that I don't.
Yeah.
You know?
Was there a Wookiee in summer?
There was a, she hooked up with a Wookiee.
And maybe got pregnant by one.
No. I mean, I think the math does.
Please let it be the goddamn Wookiee.
Sure.
And the baby's all furry. They like, it get, like, magical realism. Like, it doesn't make any sense. It was a real Wookiee.
I would prefer that, maybe, to what they might have planned for another year in the life. But for this episode, and speaking of, like, TV shows like 30 Rock, common criticism of Daniel episodes is, like, you sacrifice character or verisimilitude for joke. You sacrifice whatever, like, realism.
For bad joke.
For bad joke. So this might be an example of it right here.
Bring everything in the trailer, and there's a couple of things in the trunk.
There's a baby in the back seat, Mr. Weissman.
Bring that, too.
They check in and leave Esther in the car for, like, a good half hour.
Oh, the first time I watched, I kept yelling at Lindsay. I was like, what about, where is the baby? What about the baby? Until that moment when she says, well, I mean, till not Jimmy says there's a baby in the backseat.
Yeah.
I was like, where is she going off to without her baby? Where, what are they doing?
It is so wacky. And it seems like a self-reflexive criticism of like, yeah, we don't really like kids on this show.
Yeah.
So we're like almost like digging our heels into the idea of them being props or like something.
I read it as like a historical, like a commentary on parenting, modern parenting versus historical parenting that like helicopter parent now, and they did, you know, and I feel like that combined with the ASP, like, vision of how kids are incidental, like, I thought it was like a jab at, like, well, now you're all worried about parenting and, like, making sure your kids are with, you know, all the time having the most intellectual stimulus. But in the 50s, they would just leave them in a car.
Yeah.
Like, you can't leave a car, a baby in a car now. But
I mean,
like,
that feels criminal, even in the 50s. Was that not the widespread cultural perception back
then?
Well,
if the windows are open,
really?
Why is it criminal? It's, like, less, like, than leaving a baby inside of a, you know, like, a building or something. I don't know. It's just, like...
A building has air conditioning.
Yeah, but, like, the car wouldn't be hot if the windows...
I'm not taking into account weather conditions as much as I should.
I know. Well, no.
But it just feels like...
I just am like, well, obviously they didn't kill the baby. So right. We know that it wasn't a life or death situation.
I mean, this whole episode to me was about, and I was very sad about it. This whole episode for me was about Midge's regression.
Mm-hmm.
And in her regressed state, she's not a parent.
Yeah.
So the kid is totally an afterthought.
Of regression, because you do see her, like, obviously she has to make her comedian life a secret, and she creates this life like she's been dating a lot instead of it, and things like she really does care about, like, being a part of the swimsuit competition.
Yeah. And, I mean, her comedic life isn't even a part of her life. She's regressed. To me, it's like she's regressed to a childhood where she hasn't even considered that as part of who she is.
Yeah, and I think this episode was almost like cemented in my mind. In season one of this show, this felt like a prestige serialized show. Like, a lot of momentum. There's, like, such a tangible goal. Is Midge gonna make it? And she's doing the clubs, and she's meeting Lenny Bruce, and Jane Lynch is there, and blah blah blah. And in this episode, especially after, like, the bumps with the first couple, where it's like, we're in Paris now. What are we doing? And this is like the Paladinos once and for all saying, no, this show is just 50s stuff. Like, that's what we care about. We care about the comedian stuff too, and we're going to pay it mind, and we're going to have it play out the way it does. But more so, like, we want to digress. We want to just, like, indulge ourselves in, like, oh, the Catskills, and, like, blowing Bezos money on location shooting on the water, and just, like, yeah, let's just do some 50s stuff. And the thing is, like, I'm not even saying it as a criticism. It sounds like just a readjustment of, like, this isn't that kind of show where it's like, and then dude leads into da. It's like, now we're just going to kind of hang out and, like, take this at our own pace. Mm-hmm. I think it does just zap the comedian stuff of urgency.
I mean, I was excited when I was like, oh, they're going to the Catskills. There's going to be a whole borscht belt.
That's what I thought too. Yeah.
And then we get to the end of the episode and there's been no comedy in the whole thing. There hasn't, you know, except for Susie popping in a couple times to say, hey, remember, you're supposed to be a stand-up comedian. There's none of that. And so I was really disappointed that it didn't get there by the end of this episode.
Susie kind of functions as a Han Solo character in this episode where it's like, what are you guys doing? This is straight. Like, you guys are just like hanging out.
I love
out
that
and...
she, well, okay, but if, it depends on what you think the show is about. If you think the show is about Midge and Susie and their journey, or you think the show is about Midge and Joel and their journey, or Midge solo as an artist, it's like, I feel like the show is about this community and this family and these relationships kind of as an ensemble. And I don't really agree with the criticism that it's just 50s stuff, because to me, and I see it as a digression, like as a regression for Midge, but it also, to me, points out from the very beginning that Midge is, that she is regressed. She's a little princess who doesn't understand that you, to have a career, that you just have to work at that 365 days a year. She doesn't get that fundamentally. And this points out that still her approach to her life is she's caught between the two things, you know? And I think that's important. I think that's an important aspect of this person's journey and her life, that we tell, like, that there's this privileged lady who goes away for the summer. And it's like, of course I go away for the summer. And it's like, no, but you're trying to do this other thing. You're trying to, like, change the, you know, you're trying to change the status quo and, like, be this other thing. And it's like, oh, I can't do both things. And I think we're going to see that obviously happen. But also, I thought it was purposeful to see the 50s stuff because I thought that it was important for Joel to come back into the picture in a way that was like meaningful and not just like, what's Joel got going on? And it's important to see the way that her Midge's choices are impacting her real actual day-to-day life in the life that she's been trying to lead for her entire life, you know?
Yeah, the Joel stuff in this episode, it almost, and it's earned and it feels organic, but it's almost like there's kind of some course correction.
Happening. He's very Christopher in this episode.
Right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess he's like that archetype. Like, there's the orientation that the aforementioned, where it reminds us of town meetings and they sing songs and they do all this stuff. And then they notice they're getting some looks and glances and kind of whisperings about them. And then he tells the whole camp off.
Most of you know me, Joel Mazel. And an awful lot of you are staring at me and Midge. Now, you know what happened to us. We're separated, okay? But we're still close. Our families are close. And we love our kids, and they both love us. So everything's fine. Really. There's nothing to stare at here. You can still be friends with me or not. And you can still be friends with Midge or not. It's up to you. And Paulie, shame on you for not letting Midge in the Mrs. Steiner swimsuit pageant. She's 8 years a champion and a huge draw. And every $25 award she won, she donated to an orphan's home in the Bronx. So
feels like a
this year, thanks
move.
To you, some orphans are going hungry.
The orphan stuff.
So we're clear? Yes? Good. So have fun, everybody. See you, Dockside.
So it feels like a Sorkin move in that, like, whatever the point he was making is
also
fueled.
Trumped by...
There's also an objective righteous indignation where it's like, I'm connecting A to B to C, and this is why you're at fault here.
Yeah.
But I will say, I think, and again, for the first time, this has been common throughout this season, when he sits back down and she gives him that little smile, it's like, I get it. I literally, I went, aw. Like I said, aw, while watching it, being an audience member again. But it was very touching.
Yeah, because in season one, there's still a little bit of a sense of like, why is she with this guy?
Yeah.
But then a moment like that happens, you're like, yeah, okay, I get it.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a sense in season one until he took his shirt off.
All right, okay.
Speaking of taking his shirt off. One of
Josh.
My favorite things about this episode was the weird
the man's
lingering.
Yes.
Like, that's why I didn't think it was a Daniel episode, is because it kept having this, like, bizarre, just...
almost female gaze?
This female gaze, like, that seemed so... like, it wasn't... It was so deliberate, and it was so obvious, and it was just like, this guy's standing in his little Speedo in front of the camera for no reason except for that he's hot. For a long time.
And I kept waiting for a joke, too.
Me too.
Where it's like he would like undercut something he said.
Yeah. Nope.
So you imagine like Amy and Daniel in the edit bay. It's 2 a.m. morning and they're both producing and she's like, hold the shot a little longer.
But that's my favorite thing is that it's like there's no joke because the joke is that they're doing it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Which I love.
Yeah.
I laughed the loudest at that moment when they showed him and then they stayed on it and I laughed the loudest.
Mm-hmm.
Mazel gaze.
It's a Mazel gaze. It's a marvelous
Rishi
Mrs. Mazel
gaze. Rishi coins a phrase. When Rishi coins a phrase, you know it's going to stick around because Rishi's coined that phrase. Yeah.
We'll call you every episode from now
tuneless.
On.
And you can spell it both ways.
That's right. That's right. You know what? We actually, we got a very generous email from a listener who had some perspective on the episodes, knowing we were recording these in advance, and she shared some like historical context from a Jewish perspective, from the perspective of Judaism. And her name is Emma Fielding. So thank you so much, Emma, for your notes. And there was a few things that she kind of, I don't know what you would call the phrase, but like explained to us in terms of like context.
Jew-splained.
Is that offensive?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Emma, I know you're listening.
Is
it
know.
Offensive? Let us know. And so, you'll get an apology from me.
So, for example, Midge says at one point she's changing her name to Zippy. And Emma says Zippy is a popular Jewish nickname for girls named Zipporah. And it means bird. And then just in general, for like Catskill stuff, she says, this and all future Catskills episodes are fully embracing the American Jewish tradition that the more wealthy Jews had of summering in the Catskills. The rest is pretty much explained by watching, but in case anyone thought this was just an imitation of Dirty Dancing, it's not. They're just both portrayals of summers at camps in the Catskills with Baby and her family, although it's clearly not stated that way. So just some perspective of like, because this was a world that I was completely unaware of as
yeah,
a listener.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about 50s stuff. It's like, sure, it's 50s stuff, but like, does everybody know that wealthy Jews would go to these camp, like these weird, like Martha's Vineyard type things in, like, everyone would go to these, like, very regimented, basically, like, summer camps for adult, like, entire families. So there was activities for both adults and kids. And, like, see, I went to Michigan with Garrett this past summer, mm-hmm. and he grew up in one of these. It's a gated, like community, not a, like, it's not rich people, well, it is rich people, but the mm-hmm. houses are very run down and small. But, like, the whole idea was that, like, it was like this summer camp where people would go with their families and nobody could, like, just wander in. So your kids would just run around. Like, the whole idea was that, like, you as adults could hang out with each other, the kids could go explore, have fun, go on the lake, and there would be supervised activities all the time so that you could, like, have a nice summer if you lived in the city.
Yeah, but the Dirty Dancing parallel wasn't the first thing that came to mind for me. It was just like, it just felt like a fantastical world. And mm-hmm. I'm sure there's, like, fantastical elements that they're playing up in some
right,
ways.
Like, that much tomato juice?
Yeah, that much. Oh, yeah, Abe's whole thing, his romper situation. All
that was
stuff.
Really weird.
It was strange,
that
right?
That seemed like a Daniel
yes,
thing. Where it was like...
Daniel, very Daniel.
Right?
Well,
very
it almost seems homophobic. Like,
super,
I'm going to wear this
thing. That's
why it's
Daniel.
Thing.
Yes. Is it so homophobic? Because it's like, yeah... And Joel has to be weirded out by it.
And P.S.,
like,
his
what?
Romper rocks and
his
looks really good.
His romper, I was like, okay, this better be a crazy, like, painted-on striped thing. And then it's just like a onesie.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not at all
he
weird.
He looked good.
If he saw him in that.
And Josh is running around in his tiny
yeah,
red shorts.
It's so weird. Doesn't make any sense, Daniel.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now let's talk about your social battery. Maybe right now it's bursting at the seams with energy. Maybe it's a little drained. Maybe you're one of those people like my friend with their phone battery that keeps it 2% all the time, even when they stay home all day. And they definitely could charge up if they wanted to, but they don't. Well, regardless of where it is, it's important to understand why it is the way it is. Why is the battery low when it gets low? Is it because you're feeling less social? Is it because you're feeling sad? Is it because of emotions you've yet to identify? Or maybe just boundaries you haven't set for yourself yet? Either way, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves too thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, maybe you don't. Maybe you need a little more alone time. Well, either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. This is so important because I've been in therapy for 10 plus years, for some would say, technically, 11 years this month. And it's helped me so much understand where I get my energy from, how I use my energy, how to better use my energy, and how to maintain things in a way that's sustainable and healthy and good. And that's to do, of course, with boundaries, but also just understanding who I am and what I want. And I couldn't have done so much of that work without therapy. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GilmoreGuys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GilmoreGuys.
This HeadGum Podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt. Mm-hmm. So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
I also want to talk about the dance-off scene or the dance challenge scene. So they're all at dinner and they have the music going and stuff. And then the guy who's kind of like the activities coordinator goes up and
says...
Buzz Goldberg goes up and says, find someone with the same first and last initials as you to dance with. And it turns into this like... I had the strangest emotional reaction to this, guys, because it turns into this like really fun, really energetic musical, as much as you can be a musical without actually being a musical sort of scene where like Midge gets passed around to like five or six or seven different kinds of guys. And they all have like little dialogues with each other that then advance the plot. And she's talking to the gossip reporter and the guy she saw at the salon and a guy that he wants to, you know, get set up with another girl. And then it ends with Joel saying,
hi.
Well, hello there.
Thought we confused the hell out of everybody.
Which I thought was very Christopher.
Yeah, yes. Right?
Yeah.
And then they dance. Guys, I had the strangest reaction to the scene.
Bone zone?
But no, not B-Z. Right. Hey,
Pocket knife.
Yeah, you could feel my excitement. No, I got a little choked up watching this. Oh. It was so strange.
No, it's not. You cry all the time.
Well, okay. But I'm saying like in terms of like this isn't the preferred, this isn't the intended emotion that the show's going for in this scene, right? Is like, yeah, and then you're going to cry at this part or something. But it was just like.
You don't think it was?
I think it was just.
I think they were. I think they that it was mission accomplished. Kevin, at Kevin's house.
It's for but Kevin though was the whole thing. They wanted to choke up Kevin.
Just me in particular.
Yes. Yeah,
they
exactly.
would target.
Yeah.
I mean, Amazon has a very specific algorithm for their shows.
Should we tell him now before the show's over?
Tell me what?
Nobody else watches this.
What?
Just the friends. There's like a whole Twitter like bots. It's everything.
This is a bunker situation?
It is, yes.
Whoa.
This is a Truman show for Kevin.
Yeah.
For me, this whole scene was really complicated too. There's this thread throughout this whole episode of Midge trying, you know, getting set up by her mom and trying to make her into an eligible bachelorette. And so she's doing this initial dance. That's part of it, you know, find a guy, whatever, have this heteronormative social activity. But in order to do it, the initials that she uses are MM. She uses her married initials.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny?
Like and it's strict. She can't. She has no other choice. Like she's going for these MMs. That just seems crazy. Like that was making me go crazy. Just the irony of it. That like she's.
But that's how we know her as Midge Maisel.
But that she's continuing to
that's
identify.
What I'm it's like
as
she's
that.
Yeah. It's like is, that is who I am within these strict parameters of who what is my name? It's MM. I'm looking for a man. But I'm using
my married name.
Yeah, I just thought it was complicated.
I think that's funny.
That
I think that's really interesting because they're not even technically divorced, are they? They're just separated.
Well, they're technically married. So that was her argument for why she should stay in the swimsuit competition.
Yeah,
she's like, I'm still technically married.
Yeah,
I think stuff like that is really emblematic of, or maybe the larger macro thing from this episode is like the war of feminine identity that probably exists within Midge, which is this idea of, oh, this is your 27th year in a row going with your family and doing the thing at the and this is who you are, this is your family identity, and not that comedy represents like the rejection of that,
right?
But I think that oftentimes culturally and sometimes personally that we do operate in binaries of like you staying at home and being a mother is pathetic and bad.
Yeah.
And you being at work is good. And then the opposite, the inverse for like a lot of Bible Belt culture, Southern culture, like you going to work is really bad and you being at home is what you should be. And Midge is like in this stuff and like clinging to a name and doing these things, but also pursuing this is like challenging the binaries because she's not even all in on one thing or another. She's not a feminist hero, but she's not a homemaker either.
So this reminds me of a Bill Burr joke about...
Hey, it's me, Bill Burr.
About Arnold Schwarzenegger when he had like got caught with his nanny and it became this huge divorce with Maria Shriver, and he was talking about how it's in the context of his gold digging horse bit, which, you know, everyone should be divided about that. It's a terrible name of a bit and there's flawed premise, but there's also an interesting part of the premise that I like as a feminist. But anyway, he was talking about how Arnold Schwarzenegger, like, of course he was cheating on his wife with his nanny because his whole life up until that point was like him winning at everything that he decided to do. It's like the way the president is. It's like everything that they touch turns to gold. He just was a weightlifter who became an actor who became governor. Like everything he tried, he just succeeded at immediately with seemingly zero boundaries. So it's like, yeah, I'll have sex with my nanny. Like, because he's like, up until that point, his life is nothing but net. Like, why wouldn't you try everything that you can try? And I think Midge is coming up against this idea that because her existence on Earth is just being special, you know, aka like living in this incredible amount of privilege, but then doing with that privilege what she does, which is like, I'm amazing. I do everything perfectly. Mm-hmm. She's now, I think, coming up against a real boundary, like a real border where she's like, I should be able to be a perfect comedian and be the best at that. And at the same time, go to the Catskills for 2 months. What's the problem? Oh, that's the problem. Of course I can't do that. Those two things. Yeah. I should be able to be divorced from my ex-husband, have a modern friendship with him, raise our kids at the same time, and go be in our community. Oh, that's not easy at all. Like, nothing about that is easy. And so I think, and getting kicked out of the bikini, like, she's realizing that her life is now about this choice. Like, she has to make these choices, and now it's not going to be, like, all cake and eat it, too, for the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. And I think that is interesting from a feminist perspective, because for men, it is a cake and eat it, too. And she hasn't come up against that. There's, like, no real reason for Midge to be a feminist up at this point, because she's like, of course I can do anything I want, you know? But now she's seeing that she can't.
Yeah, so it's, like, it's not even about cultural conformity as much as it is, like, yeah, it's me.
Yeah.
I'm doing, yeah, whatever. It's almost like
she's
apathy.
Like, I'm not black, I'm OJ.
This is Midge's I'm not black, I'm OJ episode. Whoa.
I'm not female, I'm Midge.
Oh, brother.
It's a very Rory analysis of her.
Is that
like
funny?
Like, I'm Rory?
No.
Oh. Whoa, no. God. Rishi would never say that. No, no. That she is a Rory.
Oh, but that would be an
insult? She's very Rory.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that she's so yeah. Rory in that way.
Yeah.
The line that Susie has... you're like a dollop of whipped cream with a head on it. Mm-hmm. Was also, I thought that was actually the first time while watching. Now in retrospect, I'm like, what was I thinking? What was I not thinking that I never really connected her with Rory before?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of that, especially because she exists so much more within her family unit than Lorelai does within her family unit.
Right.
But
yeah.
There are sometimes more parallels to Rory's stuff than there are Lorelai stuff.
But I think everything that you just said applies to Rory.
Goes for Rory as
well.
Yeah, like the specialness being unchallenged over long periods of time might lead to entitlement and whatnot.
Yeah.
So Susie does show up to the Catskills. She carries a plunger everywhere. She gets around, which I thought was a very funny gag. But, like, to me, that's the right amount of wacky.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you could buy that, but you just see someone with a plunger and just assume they're the janitor or something.
Yeah.
And here's a line that she says, because she runs into Midge in the forest or something.
Susie.
What the fuck are you wearing?
What the hell are you doing here?
My question first.
It's my Mamie Van Doren.
You constantly astonish me.
You constantly astonish me. Did this trip you guys at all?
I loved that moment and the dollop of whipped cream, because for me, I thought both of those, it's not too often that Susie is talking about her physical qualities necessarily, but I'm definitely on board with the opinion that Susie's in love with Midge. Mm-hmm. And part of why she's in love with her is because she's so beautiful. And she has this gruff manner, and I think she masks her infatuation with some of these comments, you know, or like the way she delivers these comments. So her saying, "What the fuck are you wearing?" Yeah. is really like, I think she's kind of blown away by how beautiful she is.
Yeah,
exactly. Awuga.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Her relationship maybe to Midge is that she is gay, objectifies Midge, and is really into her, but also sees her beauty as an asset that can be exploited and doesn't understand why Midge can't. And maybe the reason, this is a super deep reading, but maybe the reason that she always is so tripped up by the fact that Midge has these standards is she's like, but you go out with Joel. Like, you go out with these guys, and I hate guys. And, like, why wouldn't you use these things? Like, if Midge was able to use her looks and her sexuality to get ahead in comedy, it would be a way for Susie to take some sort of ownership out of Midge's sexuality, which might be... I don't know, but that's kind of too deep of a read, and they're definitely not writing.
I mean, the delicacy with which Paladinos have always handled sexuality stuff that isn't just like cisgender, straight, hetero. And here's the thing. So this stuff, which like I think the reads are valid, but I don't think I would be shocked if it ever became something more than subtext, because for all intents and purposes,
you would be shocked or you wouldn't be shocked.
I would be shocked if, like, in season three, it's like, what if Susie kind of starts dating women or something like that? So it reminded me.
Well, here's how I think they could do it.
Yes,
I think they could say it doesn't need to be that she's dating women. So if somebody comes along and it's an ex-girlfriend and causes some problems for their path, and it's like, oh, it's my ex. And then everybody's like, what? You're, oh, you know, and it's like this whole thing. And she's like, yeah.
Oh, so like.
And then that's how they deal with it.
Yeah. Rather than like her discovering.
It's like, what's wrong with you that you didn't know?
Yeah.
Look at me.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
You know, I think they could easily do that. But I still, I'd be shocked if they fucking did, because there's two.
Well, let's be clear. Deft. There's 1,000 delicate and elegant ways they could do it. That's Will they choose any of them? Mm. So it kind of, there's an article out right now called Make Susie Gay, You Cowards. It's written by a woman named Mary Lynn Bernard, a.k.a. Reese. And it builds out the logic, because like sometimes this is a thing with like fandoms and shipping and like these characters need to get together. Like, you should make this character's sexuality this.
Shipping.
But the arguments laid out in this piece, I think, are so... I just found to be so interesting, almost purely, not even from like progressive perspectives of like, well, this is how we should like represent treat, but there were so many like logic points and then just like story points of why wouldn't you want to explore this? Why would that not be like this Greenwich Village woman presenting butch in a lot of ways with how she dresses and stuff? And, you know, and I want to be delicate in like not being too flippant about it, because I think it is a personal issue for a lot of people. So I don't want to be callous about the way we're talking about it. Like, nah, like, who cares? But I think the Paladinos don't have any interest. They as it stated in this article, like with Gilmore stuff, they said, we thought of some of the townies as gay. We just never said it on the show. Or like, we originally wrote Suki to be gay, but the WB said no, so we never explored that.
But the WB was always a nice little, what do you call it? Like an excuse for them to be able to not deal with those issues.
Yeah.
But now we're on a network, you know, that is like, and which the person who used to play Rory Gilmore is on another hit show playing a lesbian who's been castrated. Mm-hmm. So no more excuse, right? Mm-hmm. So what, you know, like, it's crazy.
I think it is just like, and this almost gets into our like cultural expectations for the character of Midge too. I think sometimes we project those expectations onto people who are creators to be a certain amount of progressive and a certain amount of like, guys, it's 28. What are you doing? Like,
but that's different. It's like maybe Matthew Weiner wouldn't have those expectations, but like the show, like Maisel is so gay.
You're saying
everything
like
that she does. There's so much like, I feel like appropriated gay and homosexual culture inside of her shows already that I'm just like, why? It would astonish me to imagine that the ASP couple don't have a bunch of like non-straight friends.
I think that...
I was going to say, and at least in Mad Men, they had
Sal.
Yes. Sal. Salvatore, Sal. Yeah.
So there was at least some...
They dealt with it.
Yeah, they
did. Well, that show was about cultural...
Right.
You know, subverting cultural norms.
But I just don't think that... Like, it's such an interesting... And I'm sure, like, fandoms like West Wing have gone through it with, like, why didn't Sorkin consider this? And why doesn't he have an attitude about such and such with internet stuff? And, like, maybe, like, things he missed or things that were missteps on that show where it's, like... Just this expectation of, like, I don't see Sorkin and Palladino and Weiner and all these people as being, the content is so dissimilar.
Yeah.
But I don't know if, like, the personal, like, drive and goals and motives are that dissimilar in a lot of what, obviously there's differences, but I just think, and maybe this is a very cynical take, but I just think you reach a certain amount of success and you have life in a certain stratosphere that we don't exist in, and I think things just become more important and less important. And I think a lot of it's generational too.
Yeah.
Because well, like these fine. Are all people in their 50s and stuff.
Fine. I'm fine with that. Not fine with it, but I get that. But also then maybe don't make a show that looks like The Birdcage if you want to not have gay characters.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like not everyone's going to be like Rachel Bloom, who seems like for all intents and purposes, like we want to show queer people in this sense. We want it and like is very attuned and sensitive to like mental illness communities and seems like literate in the things that they want to be. I think it's just coming up at a certain time when that just wasn't important and it wasn't a voice you heard a lot. Whereas like younger creators... I think if someone was making this show and they were like 30, I would almost be more upset.
Yeah,
I don't want this to be like they're old, so who cares? Let them, you know.
Yeah, but this is kind of predicting for the future, like why you don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, because yeah, I think if someone was like our age and they made a show, it'd be like, oh yeah, maybe there'd be different expectations.
Yeah.
But imagine like having so much of your peak success when the internet wasn't like as conversant as a source of discourse as it is now. It would be very hard to factor those things.
I guess so, but I mean, like Will and Grace is such an old show.
Yeah.
At this point, you know, like it's and these are people who all lived and wrote and created and came up. It's not like they have existed entirely in an era that was without
representation. Yeah, but it seems like maybe since Amy's writing this show, that it feels like such a return to form for her to be writing a show based in the 50s that it's like maybe she does exist in this time.
Right.
Like she doesn't like Will and Grace
because
there's
herself.
Cell phones on that show. You know, it's not because of...
Right. She's applying 1950s rules to herself.
Yeah.
I know. We've always said, like...
I would never leave the house without my hat.
It finally okay. feels like she's arrived in, like, a good strike zone for her in terms of, like, the lavish production design and a lot of the aesthetic choices. But then also, it's, like, some of the choices that are, like... I don't know what the word is, but, like, things like having to deal with... race, where like there's only two people of color in this episode. One's a cook, one's the singer lady who sings the song. Who, that woman, by the way, is a series regular on a network show.
Yeah.
And she's in like two shots of this thing where it just, anyway, it's something we talk about over and over again.
Yeah. But. And also, the person playing the central role of the Jewish hero is not Jewish.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard from Jewish people who can't watch the show because it's just like, I don't. You know, it's not silly. It's not a silly complaint. It's idiotic that they would cast somebody who's not Jewish for this. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
There's so many Jewish... It's not like there's no Jewish actresses. There's, like, millions. Like, why? It's so weird.
You know who is a gay character in this episode?
Who's that?
At the end of the swimsuit contest, the woman who wins... You know, she gets congratulated. Uh-huh. She invites Midge to go sunbathing, whatever. And then her it's her husband, right? She's married, mm-hmm. right? These women are married. Her husband, I think, comes and like gives her a kiss on the cheek and mm-hmm. takes her away. He's gay.
You think he's gay?
Absolutely. Without a doubt.
Really?
Well, I thought you were going to say the gossip columnist that Midge dances with.
Oh, right.
He's
yeah.
certainly presenting. Yeah. Maybe
in
they're dating.
Yeah.
Hey.
The guy who comes in and escorts the winner of the swimsuit pageant is the most ridiculous thing, I think, in this entire.
Oh, like, fuck. I wish you had a clip.
So ridiculous because you have to just watch. He does like that great extra thing of like, I have lines, but I'm not going to speak them,
yeah.
you know? And he says, hey, great job or something like that. Okay. And let's go over here. And yeah. he's like really dramatic yeah. and showy about it. Like he makes a hand gesture,
yeah.
but he doesn't make any words, but he also kisses her on the cheek and you can hear the sound of the kiss on the cheek. So you know that the volume is like still on in the world, but then he speaks and no sound comes out. He speaks, no sound comes out. He kisses her on the cheek, and then he speaks, and no sound comes out.
Mm-hmm.
So the sound is all off.
Yeah,
it's just a crazy, crazy thing. Yeah. At some point, Daniel really should have been like, "Hey, maybe let's do another take where we can hear your voice.
Yeah,
and we can hear you say, hey, good job, honey.'
That is
something.
So funny.
It's the most ridiculous part.
You know, someone else who's not Jewish is Zachary Levi as Benjamin.
Mm.
Zachary Levi, who people might remember most from Chuck in Chuck. And we'll see in Shazam in a couple of months, I guess.
Who is Benjamin?
Benjamin is...
The doctor.
The doctor.
Who won't row.
On the canoe. Who will not row.
Oh, right, that guy. Whoa.
But he... And I was even researching because...
Forgot all about that plot line, to be honest.
His name is Zachary Levi. So one might be forgiven to assume that he is Jewish.
Right. And he's Welsh in reality. And there was... I was even
Welsh
looking up... interviews where he was saying that he said that he wasn't cast for a lot of stuff because people told him that he looked too Jewish, which I found to be fascinating because he's also a devout Christian too. And he's very open about his faith. So just imagine I can't imagine what a bummer it must be for some people to watch like this show that's like,
yeah, that's interesting.
Like a fun take on like Jewish culture and Catskill stuff. And then to see Brosnahan and Levi playing Jewish on a boat.
Well, this isn't
falling in love.
This isn't Brosnahan's first time playing a Jewish character. And she was also on this TV show about nuclear scientists.
Oh, Manhattan.
Where she played a Jewish character.
Oh, interesting.
So it's, you know, yeah. I mean, it's one thing to cast a guy who's maybe a possible love interest or the main character
mm-hmm.
as a Gentile.
So let's talk about Benjamin.
Well,
yeah.
Yes.
Are you going to row?
No, are you?
No, the boy rows.
I don't row.
What do you mean you don't row? Everybody rows.
Then go ahead and row.
The boy rows.
Not this boy.
Pick up that oar.
It was your idea to get into a rowboat.
Pick up that oar.
Really? That tone, I might as well be rowing with my mother.
You could have suggested something else.
I'm just going along for the ride here. I was perfectly happy playing cribbage with the puppies.
Anyway, I find his voice to be almost a voice twin for Dax Shepard. I think he sounds like him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Been listening to his
podcast. He has a
very
Dax Shepardian cadence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's also kind of got like one of them tough guys. Like he's a bit of a New Yorker accent in some way. Like it's slight. It's not heavy. I think I've seen like two episodes of Chuck, so I have no like Levi takes. But I thought he was an interesting... He looks so physically different from what I remember him to be. He seemed like so much more like a solidly built... man, like a 50s kind of dreamboat guy. But I liked it. Like, I like the idea of like the disinterested love interest as a type.
Yeah, I think that's very His Girl Friday, like meet cute sort of, we hate each other, so let's fall in love.
Well, especially for Midge, who
does
expect. Well, when she says, I'm Midge Maisel, he says...
You say that like I'm expected to know
what
this is. She's like, well,
which of course she is. Like I know who you are.
Yeah.
Like I should know that or something like that. Yeah. But yeah.
If you had, you would have already been in love with me. Like I say, to know me is to mute me.
I feel like to know me is to mute me. As we were discussing pre-pod. Oh, fun off mic discussions. But
I have a lot of affection for Chuck, the TV show.
For the show.
Because they put three of my songs in that show.
Really?
And that helped me a lot.
Which band?
Financially.
Which band?
The 1 AM radio.
The 1 AM radio, okay.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. In 2011, They used three different songs in three different episodes.
So you almost have this Pavlovian reaction. When you see Levi, you just see dollar signs.
You see dollar signs.
And gratitude.
Yeah.
I mean, I really liked him in this. I know he's in a few more episodes at least, but I thought this would be an easy character to play in a way that's annoying or just is kind of grating, just like, because he's like such a limp, passive nothing mm-hmm. in the episode until he gets a little scene with Joel. But I felt like the way he played it was like interesting enough.
You thought he was a limp? I loved his curmudgeonliness on the
boat.
Yeah,
I did too. Yeah. I didn't think he was limp. Yeah.
No, but I'm saying limp in the sense like he literally won't row. Mm-hmm. Limp in that sense, yeah. Where he's like, no, I'm not going to take action.
But yeah. it came across more as obstinate mm-hmm. yeah. to me than limp.
And uncharmed, which I really appreciated.
Yeah.
When the charming person finds someone who isn't charmed by them, that's always, I love those kind of scenes. Mm-hmm. And then, it does conclude with, I guess, some green screen fireworks stuff. I mean, all the episode looks great, but I think there's a little bit of green screen action.
That's the best way to shoot fireworks, to be honest.
Is green screen
stuff. It's super, super dangerous.
Of course.
It's to shoot fireworks because the way you have to get them in proximity mm-hmm. and like the... It's so much insurance and extras. It's just like pointless when you could just green screen it. Because I didn't notice.
Yeah. Well, Joel sees the Weissman family on the blanket he hears the song "You Belong to Me" by Joe Stafford, which mm-hmm. I think they used in season one too.
I think it's Pat Benatar actually.
Pat Benatar.
Yeah.
"You Belong to Me." Rishi, how do you feel about like the soundtrack generally in this show? A lot of needle drops.
It's interesting. That they are not like strict about the time period at all with the needle drops.
Yeah.
I think maybe you haven't come to this episode yet, so I won't tell you, but there are some songs later that show up in the show that are completely
really
not of the time period.
That's so mm-hmm. interesting.
Not during, like in the end credits.
Yeah.
Like, well, are we talking Bach or like?
I feel like that's pretty consistent like, though. Like modern. End credits seems yeah. anachronistic.
Yeah. So what have been some of the other end credits songs that you've?
Girls Talk, Dave Edmonds covers the Costello song that's in the pilot. In this episode, the song that ends it is Rock the Boat by Hughes Corporation, which I think is like 60s or 70s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think they break it when they do credits. But
even in the episodes, they're a little loosey-goosey with it. There's like when they go to the Catskills, there's an Ed Ames song.
Yeah.
Like, Let's Get Away or whatever mm-hmm. it's called. But that's from the 60s. Mm-hmm. That's not from 1959.
Right.
From making such a, you know, starting the episode with the crayon rubbing of 1959.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They're probably playing, I would imagine, by Stranger Things rules with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because where Stranger Things is like set in generally the 80s and they'll play songs from like 1986, mm-hmm. when it's 82. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like that's one way, and they're not. Like Weiner, who would be like, I can't have a label made before 1954.
Right.
Get it off my set. They're not particular like that. But he sees him on the blanket, and then Benjamin bums a smoke off of him, and they have the following conversation.
What?
You think we're ever really forgiven for the mistakes we've made?
What do you want doing the forgiving, God?
People
never forgive. Not in my experience. They say they do, but they don't. I'm not even sure forgiveness really matters.
Why wouldn't it matter?
Well, what is it, forgiveness? It doesn't mean anything. I mean, you still did what you did, right? Nothing's changed. Forgiveness is a mindset. Synapses in your brain telling you to think differently about something that's already happened. It's amorphous. It's not really there. And if it's not really there, what is it?
God, I hope that's not true. Every day, I feel like I'm getting kicked in the head a little. I know I deserve it, but I sure would like it to end someday.
Just do what I do, stay away from people. If you're not around them, there are no mistakes to be made.
That's not the answer. You know that. You need people.
It's a bummer life.
That's what you need them for.
Nah.
You need Midge.
You'll change your mind someday.
Oh, foreshadowing.
Just wait.
Foreshadowing.
You'll see.
Ah, foreshadowing.
Hey, you know
what? What's crazy is this scene begins with them both talking about how antisocial they're feeling.
Yeah.
And then they get into this very immediately
with each other.
Yeah. Very deep thing. Do you think forgiveness is a thing? Hey, stranger.
Oh, yeah. Joel's jumping into the deep end.
Hey,
yeah.
Stranger. I hate people.
Yeah.
Joel's far from the shallow.
Let's talk about it.
Now.
And then he says, he's far. And then Benjamin totally engages. He's like, okay, weirdo, I'm going to now walk away that you I've got bummed the light from you.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, oh, yeah, let's have this philosophical conversation.
That was a play.
Also,
that was a one-act play.
It seems like the longest and most uninterrupted finale of a fireworks display ever. Because the whole time they're talking, it's like, beep, boop, boop, beep, 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 beep.
It lasted for 2.5
so
hours.
So long. I thought this scene was bullshit because I was like, okay, so what is it that Joel, I thought Joel was firmly, here's Joel's conflict. He's in love with Midge. Midge is in love with him. He wants to be Midge's husband, but he also doesn't have much outside of that. And he needs more outside of it because Midge is so great and is an amazing comedian. He wanted to be a comedian, so his ego is shattered and he has to find a way to like build up his ego again. Yeah. And he knows he can't stand being the husband of a popular comedian. And he knows that. So he's taken that hit and it's like that he's dealing with it. Now then he's like, do we ever get forgiven for mistakes? What are you talking about? That's over. You're done with that part. That's not the problem.
Is time a construct?
Yeah, it's like, was it like a flat circle? Is time more of a flat circle? Like, what are you doing? I don't understand. It felt like such,
aren't we all just walking here?
It was like emo babble, you know?
Emo babble should have, that's what they should have called Joel.
Emo
babble?
Babble?
Yeah.
Are you in or out on Joel? You want reconciliation?
Out on Joel. Oh, come on.
Oh, my God.
Get out of here. Take those abs elsewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, there's space right over here, but still.
I'm ultimately with Rishi, although I see his appeal more in season two. But overall, I just wanted to get out of the picture and Midge to do the Tonight Show or whatever she's going to do.
No.
No. See, no. You're more interested in this stuff than you are the comedy stuff.
Yeah, because the comedy stuff is solid. And if I'm like putting myself in Midge Maisel's shoes, it's just a matter of time before you get to be on The Tonight Show.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like it's like just a tunnel. You just got to go through it. There's no plot there. Right?
What if
my life has been that way? Like there's no, what I get out of my career, I put into it.
Mm-hmm.
But with romance, it's different, and it's complicated by the aspects, by the other things. Mm-hmm. The life pursuit is what is complicating. You know what I mean? Because it's because of who I am, which I attribute to being a comedian, that my romantic life is complicated,
mm-hmm.
right?
I allow for the possibility that Joel could have his own evolutionary arc that gets him to a place where I feel like he deserves Midge. But right now, he doesn't. This is the first episode where, you know.
Oh, I thought you said you allow for the idea. I thought you said you laugh at the idea. And I was like, well, I like that.
Pity the idea.
No, I think that could happen. But I don't think he's there yet. He starts to show it just a bit in 204 with that speech at orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
This guy has some backbone because that's what I think he's been lacking up until this point. And if he can show more of that, that'll inch me closer to the idea that maybe they should be together.
You think what he needs is backbone?
Yes.
Hmm.
What do you think he needs?
I think he needs to like be his own person.
Yeah.
Get out from under the thumb of his dad. And he has to be and have enough,
security
to feel like he can support his wife for her own as an entire person, not just an extension of him.
Yeah. Yes. And the central question in 201 where it's like, he says, I can't be a joke. Well, maybe you can. Maybe it's actually fine if you're like a joke. Like, he's saying, like, I can't just be fodder for your act and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but
blah,
that's
blah.
Like really, I guess, the security, the emotional security, the person who is sure of who they are is like excited to know that part of their behavior is being parodied into this, into this successful comedy act because it doesn't actually define who they are because they're secure in their who they are.
Yeah.
It's like, I am not a joke. Why would I be because my wife writes jokes about our marriage, that doesn't mean I'm a joke. But that does to Joel because he doesn't have any backbone, like you say.
Yeah.
Right. The ability to be able to take someone when there's parts of you that can feel easily threatened, it's just indicative of like a larger thing.
Yeah.
That if the larger thing was fine, you'd be like, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's whatever.
Yeah.
I get it.
Like Garrett loves it when I talk about him mm-hmm. in my act.
And you do a lot.
Because he, I think, I'm not putting words in his mouth, but it's not the only thing. But it, to him, like, I feel like he sees me as somebody who he can go toe-to-toe with on a human level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's like, oh, this person will really give me a run for my money in a way that is, you know, enriching my own life, as opposed to like, who am I?
What you know? A wonderful feeling.
It's an incredible feeling, yeah. You know? Because
like the kind challenge of a secure, loving relationship, where it's almost like
I wouldn't recommend it to everyone, but yeah.
Well, no, just not kidding. No, it doesn't work for everyone, but almost this idea of like, there's almost like this threat of like, I could maybe destroy you or hurt you, but I don't want to because I love you.
Yeah.
And this idea of like, I can just being able to call one another out and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Be lovely.
Oh, my God.
And yes, Joel is not there.
Not there. No.
And Midge could destroy him. Joel can't
but
really
he just,
destroy Midge.
He has that little bit of like, maybe somebody else can. Yeah. Like, and he's like, he knows it might even work. Like, mm-hmm. It might even be a possibility, but he sees himself as really limited, which I get because fucking look at his dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And his mother, Jesus Christ.
Mazel tov for not going to the garment factory for an episode for once.
Mazel
tov. Don't need it. Don't need that. Garment factory stuff. Maybe it gets more interesting as it goes on.
Maybe if Tim Gunn or Simon Doonan guests.
Going back to when Susie was like, what the hell are you wearing? Another. What the hell is Midge wearing on her head? The yellow like infinity symbol thing?
Oh, yeah. You know? It's very Scientological.
Is it a bow?
I'm just kidding. I don't know. But
is it a bow? I asked Lindsay, my wife, who is a fashion designer, what it is, and she declared it to be a summer hat, quote mm-hmm. unquote, summer hat.
Yeah.
Does she dig the styles in this show, Lindsay?
Yeah. I mean, well, it's like period. It's not really her period.
I would be so curious as to like what a modern fashion designer would think of some of this stuff. Because to me, it looks like coming from a basic non-professional perspective, everything everyone's wearing feels dazzling all the time. And that might just be like a sensory reaction to pretty colors and symmetry. But like, I would wonder if it's like, if that appeals to someone who works in it currently.
Yeah, it's not really her vibe.
No, I get off on the fashion stuff. Especially, I would like to point out now that Rose has been to France and back, her style has really evolved. If you pay attention to what she was wearing prior to going to Paris and then coming back, she was very like suited up, normal Jackie O, and now she's come back from Paris and she's wearing all these textures and these like interesting, very like late 50s, early 60s type of stuff, where Midge is actually still very like, I'm a Barbie doll type mm-hmm. thing.
Well, there's this really good interview with Maren Hinkle on some WNYC show where she talked about the costume designer when they went to Paris and shot, they literally gave her more room. And the dresses, like they let it out a little bit. So it was like a little bit looser and a little bit like more room to breathe, literally, mm-hmm. and like less corseted and mm-hmm. stuff. And then how that like created this thing in her where it's like, yeah, I feel more relaxed and chilled out. Mm-hmm. So I think that's absolutely intentional in how they're dressing her. But yeah, you're right. The Midge still looks like, especially like, oh man, I love that outfit when she's playing ping pong and it's like the little, not cutoffs, but the short shorts and the tight.
Those bloomers? Yeah. Do you call those bloomers?
Bloomers. Maybe.
Perhaps.
I really love the outfit though when she gets to, she goes to the cat, she says, we're going to the Catskills when she's wearing all yellow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like that was fabulous. And the infinity symbol hat.
Yeah.
Which it's like the idea that you would dress in any way besides ultimately like, a gunny sack for a fucking, what is it, 6-hour car ride? But she's sitting in this all yellow getup, and it's just like, I love that shit. That I dig entirely because I would totally do something like that.
I also thought it was a surprising but excellent color for Rachel Brosnahan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who is very pale.
Now, Rishi, would you ever get a romper?
I don't think so. And I asked Lindsay this too. I pulled up the Rompim website and I was like, and I was like, this is a no, right? And she's like, no.
But it's a thing for guys. Guys wearing one, but like a mechanic suit or like an overall.
But then you look like a mechanic.
A coverall. No, not if you style it right.
Well, style me right.
I will.
Will you?
Yes.
Okay, I'll wear it in the finale of this show.
Awesome.
Okay, great.
I can do it. I can figure it out. Yeah.
It needs to have the right drape.
Right, just us. We feel like right. we can't.
For you, it needs to have the right drape, and it definitely needs to be tailored.
Okay.
We're not going to do like a, you know.
Damn
like
it, a tailored.
Yeezy seasoned.
No, and I wouldn't expect us to. Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, what a fun episode. Sorry it wasn't one of your faves of the season, yeah. Rishi. I didn't know that when I signed it to
you. Well, you know, I'm watching the show for the comedy arc.
Yeah.
That's what I want to watch Midge realize that there is a world outside of her world mm-hmm. and then go there. And yeah. this whole episode was about, in some ways, the whole episode to me felt like a flashback.
You're so right.
Like yeah. a flashback happening in the present tense.
Yeah.
Where she, I guess I would have loved it if she was in it and had some more
yeah.
Of an ambiguous relationship to it.
Like a fever dream. Yeah. And it feels like there was parts when I felt like it could have been broken really easily when they were in the town meeting or when they were at dinner, when we're looking at the scene from the perspective of the stage, and there's a microphone in the front, and it's like, where have we seen this before in this show? And it's always from
and it looks like
when
a
Midge
chicken wing to her,
up.
Like a cartoon.
Yeah,
character.
And then somebody goes up and they're like, bad joke or whatever, and then somebody remarks like, oh, this is terrible, and she's like, yuck. But like, why isn't that a moment?
Right.
That should really yeah. be a moment yeah. where she's like realizes how her mother is reacting to this.
I could have done that better.
Or the part when Abe is laughing uproariously because he's so drunk. It's like, well, you like this because you're drunk.
Right.
And it's like, but you like it because you're drunk, huh? Mm. You know, like there should have been, that should have been pointed.
It was like
sure.
she had lost any
yeah.
connection to yeah. her stand-up comedian self.
Yeah.
And I would have liked to have seen, yeah, that she could somehow see the edges deteriorating of this thing that she had loved so much.
Yes.
Suddenly now she sees it. Now that she's been through the looking glass, yeah. she comes back and she can be like, oh, some of this stuff feels a little hollow.
Yeah.
But she didn't. She was fully bought in.
Yeah, she was fine.
And there was no distress.
No, but I think the swimsuit competition and the things about it that she used to like and the fact that like every aspect of it is her getting questions mm-hmm. about Joel. Like, I think that part felt a little bit like it was shattered.
She was sad that she could no longer part, like her decision has these consequences and
right.
she's dealing with the consequences, but, and it's negative in that she doesn't get to do this thing that she really wanted mm-hmm. to, but she doesn't have this feeling of like, maybe this stuff isn't actually so great. Like maybe
yeah.
this is actually very, very small and provincial mm-hmm. and I have gotten into like the bigger pond. Shouldn't she see this world a little bit differently, and really it's only
yeah.
like it's still positive
it
to her.
And yeah, it doesn't need to be, and like, but what you're saying makes me feel like it's this whole like she's really like out of it the whole time, but it really doesn't need to be that. It could be just a couple moments of like where it's like this dance challenge is like happening and she's like, oh, I love a dance challenge, but then it's not quite as fun as it
yes.
would be if she could just like get like, you know, accidentally shoved on stage like she likes to do or whatever,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. No, that's what I mean. I didn't, yeah. I don't want it to be all.
Yeah, because I
negative.
Feel like at the same time, Maisel, like her thing is to make the best of everything
right.
that happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But just a couple things here mm-hmm. and there.
To show but some progress.
Some, exactly,
right.
some evolution.
Right.
But it's that's why right. it felt like a regression to me.
Because
mm-hmm. like she's completely come back and it's like she never had that part of her
right.
life.
Right.
The only part that seems to have progressed is obviously the brokenness in her relationship with Joel. Like, that's the only thing. But for her personally, and again, like, is that them saying, well, this is kind of what we care about a little bit more. I don't know. And you finished the season, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is your favorite episode in the latter half?
Yeah.
Of the season?
That's
yes.
exciting.
Cool,
yes.
that's fun.
Yes, definitely. It definitely gets better.
Think about. Okay.
As it goes
It gets
on.
Better as it goes along. Yeah.
Oh,
oh,
nice.
Yeah.
Because I heard my friend Glenn Weldon said that it gets worse as
oh.
it goes on. Like the first half starts
life.
Strong. You know why? He was talking about my life and my career.
Oh, okay.
I won't
yeah.
say,
he is married.
Yeah.
I won't say that it gets better, consistently better as it goes along.
Yeah.
But the better stuff happens in the second half.
Okay, nice.
I think.
God
yeah.
damn, I'm excited about that.
Because it's more comedy stuff. I know. Are you going to keep watching week to week like I am?
Yeah,
are
it's
you gonna
hard
go bingy
because I hear that and I'm like, but I'm
gonna
bingy wingy.
we could watch together too if you want.
Yeah, I'll
I can
see
make
my
some
schedule.
Air pop
happening.
Pop.
Yeah,
okay.
maybe.
I know.
No, I would love that because recently Garrett decided to stop hanging out with me.
so you'll be my fill-in boyfriend.
Yeah. Ooh, that's a good. Have you ever been that in any of your female friendships before?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I'm not familiar with that concept in the slightest. Rishi, thanks for joining us on the show. Well, you had another note.
Just one thing.
Yeah.
We can cut it now. Now we were out in the outro.
No. Listen, West Wing Weekly, Song Exploder, these are tight diamond packages of podcasts. There is not a wasted second. Not the case on Maisel Goyce, so.
Nope. I'm involved, so it's going to be a
my favorite
sort of a train wreck.
Yeah.
There was one line that I thought, Daniel, that was pretty good. There's just one moment. My favorite thing, I think, in the episode is the voice in the PA, voiceover in the PA where he says, not an emergency, but not an emergency.
That was really funny. I laughed at that too. Yeah. But not an emergency. And it's also at the beginning, which is amazing.
That's great.
Yeah. Daniel saw Wet on American Summer and said, I want to do that too.
Yeah. that was what I thought of more so than Dirty Dancing.
It felt like
Wet Hot American Summer was the first thing that I thought of while watching.
Yeah. Wes Anderson American Summer.
Wes Hot American Summer.
Actually, it's Baba Didi.
Baba Didi.
Baba Didi. Oh.
Yeah.
By the way, Baba Didi is a very scary movie that she made later on. Baba Didi.
Baba Didi.
Rishi, where can people find you?
People can find me on social media, I guess.
At Rishi Hirway.
Yep.
Listen to West Wing Weekly. You guys are in season 7 currently.
Season 6.
Wow. Still season 6?
We're just at the beginning of season 6.
Oh, okay. I thought you just finished. Okay, gotcha.
Yep.
Cool. How's it going?
It's going great. I am now I was watching week to week as we went through season 5, and then we got to season 6, and I started really digging it, and now I've like binged.
6 has fun stuff.
Oh, I'm really into it.
Allison Janney gets that new haircut. It's fun.
Can I go watch with... There wasn't... One of the reasons I haven't watched... Is because
me,
you have to be at my house.
I'm holding you back, but you don't want me at your house.
Yeah, I know, that's true.
You see the conflict.
Hey, I'm gonna come over and we're gonna watch the next.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Oh, that'd be lovely. Please listen to West Wing Weekly and not your ex podcast, but a podcast that you still consult on, but no longer host Song Exploder.
It's a show that I created.
You created, yes.
And now someone else is hosting.
Yeah, so that's kind of like. What would be the equivalent of it? It's like you're Johnny Carson and that person's Jay Leno. Well, let me think of a different one. Because it's something where it's like, but you know what? He didn't create The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the analogy is, but Song Exploder is wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful podcast everyone should hear. Alice, where can people find you?
AliceWetterlund.com.
Net.
At Alice Wetterlund on social media. I'm not on Facebook anymore,
and,
you guys. You
and can't listen to Treks in the City.
And I have my podcast on Forever Dog Network, Treks in the City. Please listen and rate us if you like it. If you don't like it, slide into my DMs. Let us know. But please don't rate us if you don't like it, because there's a lot of people out there who make it their blood sport to downgrade podcasts via the rating system.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
I know. Gilmore Guys currently has 4.5 stars.
That's what we have on Tracks.
Oh,
4.5.
Yeah, it makes me crazy.
Yeah.
You can follow me at Kevin T. Porter. You can listen to Good Christian Fun. Get the word out on that. You don't have to be a Christian. It's not a trap. Just come on. The water's fine, y'all.
Good Christian
Drink
fun.
The Kool-Aid.
It's not a trap.
Alice was on it. You had a good old Christian time.
Do you know this is the first? This is not the first podcast on which I was a goy guest.
Oh, what's the other one?
I was once on an episode of Unorthodox.
Duh. Okay.
A podcast about Judaism, and I was the goy of the week.
You were the goy of the week, but the hosts were Jewish people.
Yes, and I was on it with Josh, who was the Jew of the week. We were usually they have one and then another. We were a combo package of Jew and Goy of the Week.
In this recording studio, we're all Goy all the time.
No.
Not all the time. No, but the three of us here, you know, we'll have some non-Goys on in the future. Let's go out with the song that closes this episode, Rock the Boat by Hughes Corporation. All right.
Yacht Rock.
Rishi, you should come on season 3. I'll pick a comedy... hard comedy episode.
Unless she
for
stops
you.
Doing comedy in season 3.
Oh no. Right. It's just her in the Catskills for all of season 3.
She gets a job there.
Oh my gosh. By the way, this feels weird to end a show with you in less than 2 hours. Isn't this fun and novel? All right, we'll see you next week.
Abi gesund.
Abi Gesundheit.
Happy New Year. I mean, it will be well into the new year by the time.
Oh, we're in April now.
Yeah. Ever since our voyage of love began. That was a HeadGum Podcast.